to conference venue for a live coverage of Islamic Unity Week conference.
On this occasion,
سماحة الشيخ العلامة المرحوم آية الله التسخيري رضوان الله عليه وحرصه الدائم
give our closest to the loss of the Ayatollah Taskhiri, and we know that his concern for the unity of the nation. Dear brother who was concerned to hold the conference today, and in my name, my brothers in the Jihad, Islamic Jihad, I tell you and our dear brother in the Islamic Republic of Iran, I tell you and Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, may God preserve and keep him. The Islamic Republic of Iran, I give you my prayers, and I give, say that I will hold Daiman, we always have the spirit of all the
this
in the face of the Western nation and attack. They always try to orchestrate wars and confrontations. And this land of Palestine, the jewel of history,
building
accords, in light of a continuous Judaization of Al-Quds,
والسعي المحموم إلى تفريغ القدس من أهلها وأصحابها الشرعيين.
But empty Al-Quds from its people and its natives and its legitimate inhabitants. They gave 10 minutes, so you only have 5 minutes. And here in Palestine, if the uprising of the world is through Palestine, is to liberate it from the Zionist occupation. The unity between Muslims is a religious duty, and the differences between the Muslims among themselves. And it is Islam, the only religion that allows other beliefs to their religions.
وفي هذا الإطار فإننا ندين كل الاتجاهات التي تنحو إلى نزع صفة الإسلام وتكفير المخالفين.
We try to remove any sort of qualifications on Islam that it is not a tolerant faith.
Secondly, we are on the المسلمين هي نتاج مشاريع أمنية واستخبارية غربية.
So believe this fight between the continuous conflicts between the Muslims is part of a project, a wide project. And those differences and conflicts are only to serve political interests and political agendas. Because as unity between the Muslims requires that there is a project and a plan for the Muslims to live together. We stress that Palestine represents the cause for all Muslims and Christians, so it represents for all of us. We need to face the Zionist occupation and support the Palestinian resistance. The Palestinian who have not stopped at anything to sacrifice their sons and me and their lives for the sake of country. And Palestinians free in their resistance. Including the people launched in order to defend Al-Quds. And I see that is my duty to thank the government for its and the continuation of this support for our people in the face of beginning the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. At the end, I ask God to do your efforts and the victories that we are together and victory is always our full point and peace be upon you.
Right, you have just listened to Ziad al-Nakhala, head of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, who gave the opening speech of the 35th Islamic Unity Conference, which is being held here in Tehran. Today is the 12th of Rabiul Awal on the Islamic lunar calendar. It's the auspicious date of the birth anniversary of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, according to the Sunni tradition. The 17th of the month of Rabiul Awal, just 5 days from now, is the birthday anniversary of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, according to the Shia tradition. And the interval between these 2 5 days is the Islamic Unity Week. It's been named Islamic Unity Week by the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Ruhollah Khomeini, may God bless his soul. We're now waiting for the other speakers in this conference to make their speeches. And we're also waiting Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, who's also due to make a speech at the conference. For now, we'll take a short break. We'll be back.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
With weeks to go before the COP26 climate summit, documents show British Prime Minister Boris Johnson being warned about the risks of damage to the UK's economy from green investment. We're prepared for an article written jointly by Toby Helm and Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled UK Treasury Leak Reveals Rift Between Johnson and Sunak Over Costs of Zero Carbon Economy. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Observer. Confidential documents leaked to The Observer reveal an extraordinary rift between British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his Chancellor Rishi Sunak over the potential economic effects of moving towards a zero-carbon economy, with just weeks to go before the crucial COP26 climate summit in Glasgow. As Boris Johnson prepares to position the UK at the head of global efforts to purportedly combat climate change and curb greenhouse gas emissions as host of the Glasgow COP26 meeting, the documents show the Treasury is warning of serious economic damage to the UK's economy and future tax rises if the UK overspends on or misdirects green investment. Green experts said the half-baked and one-sided Treasury net zero review presented only the costs of action on emissions, rather than the benefits, such as green jobs, lower energy bills, and avoiding the disastrous impact of global heating. They said the review could be weaponized by climate change deniers around the world before COP26, undermining Boris Johnson's attempts at climate leadership on the global stage. The internal Treasury documents say that while there may be economic benefits to the UK companies from swift and appropriate climate action, there is also a danger that economic activity could move abroad if firms found their costs were increasing by more than those of their overseas competitors. The leaked papers are understood to have been produced to accompany a slideshow given confidentially to key groups outside government in the last month. The documents state the investment required to decarbonise the UK economy is uncertain, but could help to improve the UK's relatively low investment levels and increase productivity. The document said, however, more green investment is likely to attract diminishing returns, reducing the positive impact of ever more investment on gross domestic product or GDP. Some green investment could displace other more productive investment opportunities. If more productive investments are made earlier in the transition, this risk may be accentuated later in the transition. The risk of additional costs to companies from green initiatives, the document says, climate action in the United Kingdom can lead to economic activity moving abroad if it directly leads to costs increasing and it is more profitable to produce in countries with less stringent climate policies. On the fiscal implications, the documents say the cost of moving towards net zero would mean tax rises because of the erosion of tax revenue from fossil fuel-related activity. They say the government may need to consider changes to existing taxes and new sources of revenue throughout the transition in order to deliver net zero sustainably and consistently with the government's fiscal principles. Ed Matthew, campaign director at the E3G think tank, said, "To governments looking to COP26, this looks unprofessional and embarrassing. The United Kingdom is standing in front of the world at COP26, trying to galvanize ambitious action from every country. If the government has not presented the robust economic case in favor of action, that's going to be significantly undermine those attempts." The Treasury's approach is also starkly at odds with that of Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng and the analysis of the Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, in a report published in July of this year. On the costs moving towards net zero, the Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, said in its report, "Between now and 2050, the fiscal costs of getting to net zero in the United Kingdom could be significant, but they're not exceptional. While unmitigated climate change would spell disaster, the net fiscal costs of moving to net zero emissions by 2050 could be comparatively modest." The Committee on Climate Change, the government's statutory advisor, has also repeatedly said the costs of action are small and diminishing, at less than 1% of gross domestic product GDP by 2050, while the costs of inaction are large and rising. While there are concerns over how the costs could fall on poorer households, the Committee on Climate Change, the CCC Chief Executive Chris Stark, has made clear that ministers can choose to distribute the costs and benefits fairly through the design of green policies. White House sources said there was a belief that Rishi Sunak was keen to position himself as something of a climate change skeptic in order to boost his popularity within the Tory party and draw comparisons with Boris Johnson's green enthusiasm. The sources added, "Rishi Sunak clearly sees an interest in showing he's not really down with this green stuff. He wants Boris to own the whole agenda." A source at the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy confirmed that the Treasury was kicking back against many of the green plans being advanced by Number 10 and by Kwasi Kwarteng. The source said, "There are not climate change deniers, but they're emphasizing the short-term risks rather than long-term needs, which is what we are emphasizing." In contrast to the Treasury's caution, Labour Party committed at its recent party conference to invest £28 billion extra every year until 2030 to secure a green transition, creating good jobs with decent wages in the process. The leak comes as the British government prepares to publish its long-awaited net zero strategy and heat and building strategy, which will contain policies on cutting emissions and creating green jobs, including a ban on new gas boilers from 2035 and grants for householders to move to green heating. The government's COP26 president, former business secretary Alok Sharma, is embarking on a frantic last-ditch round of diplomacy, including with Chinese representatives, amid speculation that President Xi Jinping of China will not attend the talks. The United States and the European Union are also talking to key high-emitting countries in the final weeks before COP26, which opens on 31st of October. The Treasury said the government is committing to tackling climate change, and the Prime Minister has set out an ambitious 10-point plan to help us achieve that. The Treasury is playing a crucial role in this effort by allocating £12 billion to fund a plan, setting up the UK Infrastructure Bank to invest in net zero and committing to raise £15 billion for projects like zero-emission buses, offshore wind and schemes to decarbonise homes.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address the most important issues in the South Asian region, what's going on, who are the key actors involved, what are the people saying and how are the issues changing the future. All of this will be answered with the help of our team of experts and guests. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at Afghanistan, where Daesh killed more than 100 Shia Muslims by bombing a mosque. And we will discuss how Britain's actions hundreds of years ago are responsible for conflict between China and India today.
On October 8, 2021, a Daesh suicide attack claimed the lives of almost 100 Shia Muslims and left several others wounded. The residents who were travelling to the mosque in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz probably had no idea that they might not return. Or maybe they did. Shias have for long been targeted by Daesh. The Shias in Afghanistan in particular are easy to identify. This is because the Shia sect in Afghanistan is followed predominantly by the third largest ethnic group in Afghanistan, the Hazara.
In 1880, the Hazara community was comprised of landed nobility, peasants and artisans. Now the Hazara community focuses on how to survive and not get killed. The reason is simple. The Hazara predominantly follow the Shia sect of Islam, and as the third largest ethnicity in Afghanistan, they live in ghettos. Because they live in ghettos and because their facial features are distinct from other Pashtuns, they become easy targets. Being Shia and therefore both a religious and a visible ethnic minority, Hazaras are particularly vulnerable. Even before the October 8 bombing, suicide bombings targeting Hazara public events have taken place with increasing regularity, most of which have been claimed by groups stating allegiance with Daesh. These include, in July 2016, the killing of 85 people at a peaceful protest comprised of mostly Hazaras. It was the deadliest attack on civilians since 2002 and targeted the Hazara on the basis of their Shia religious identity. Other attacks include a December 2017 bombing that left at least 41 dead and another 80 injured in a Hazara neighborhood of western Kabul, and an assault in March 2018 that resulted in the deaths of at least 9 people. So why are Shias a problem? Well, right after the Iranian Revolution of 1979, the West and allies had feared that the Iranian revolutionary spirit was spread beyond borders. The revolution was religious in nature, thus part of anti-Iran training, which was fueled by billions of Saudi petrodollars and West-made ammo, included propaganda against Shiism directly. Daesh and Al-Qaeda fighters were taught that followers of the Shia sect of Islam were infidels and thus they not only had a license to kill these people, who followed the same sect of Islam as Iranians were following, but were encouraged to do so.
There is confusion as how Daesh suddenly became active again, just after the US left and just after China announced its support for infrastructure projects in Afghanistan. As Taliban officials shift from leading an insurgency to forming a functioning state, the Islamic State is trying to undercut Taliban's promises, and it clearly seems that there is reason beyond hate. For the US, using proxies to create instability is like a walk in the park. The Taliban now are from the same freedom fighters which the US supported in Afghanistan for its war against the invading USSR. When former US President calls former President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton the co-founders of Daesh, maybe that's the only statement from Trump which is relevant here.
Daesh remained diminished from its zenith. However, since the Taliban came to power after 20 years of conflict, Daesh's Levant Khorasan ISIL-K sector has revived. According to a letter from the chair of the United Nations Security Council, the terrorist group has come forward with a new, ambitious leader called Shahab al-Muhajir. The group is now active and dangerous and positions itself as the sole pure rejectionist group in Afghanistan to sway the hate mongers in Afghanistan among its ranks. This reminisces with how Daesh first came into scene. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad formed a stronger alliance with Russia and Iran. Rebels and Daesh sprung up in the region to take control. Iranian General Qasem Soleimani takes down Daesh in the region. US targets him and kills him in a cold-blooded act of war. Now that the Taliban have come to take control after humiliating the US, and now that they have joined hands with China, Daesh suddenly re-emerges with astute sophistication in Afghanistan. After the Taliban cleaned up the chaos created by US in Afghanistan, China announced $31 million in emergency aid to the war-ridden country in order to help its people. Furthermore, according to Global Times, a member of the Chinese business group in Kabul said that they have already made agreements with domestic enterprises and other organizations to jointly build a platform in Kabul will provide services like personnel safety, government liaisoning, and bank exchange, tax and logistical services to the Afghan Institute, according to Global Times. With rehabilitation plans and bloc formation of China, Pakistan, Iran, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan, the US definitely faces a checkmate situation when it comes to geostrategic power struggle in the South Asian arena, and it seems as though Daesh is the last breath which US can take before its influence completely drowns in the region.
Now, for more insight, we are joined by Mr. Mustafa Ariyai from the Netherlands. He is an author at Covert Action magazine. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Ariyai.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Now, could you begin by telling us more on the recent suicide bombing, which killed almost 100 Shia Hazara Muslims in Afghanistan, and who seems to benefit from this horrific act of violence?
And with your permission, I would like to express my sorrow and condolences to the family, to my Afghan compatriots. And I would also like to obviously condemn this inhumane attack against innocent civilians in the strongest terms possible. Unfortunately, this is an ongoing effort to destabilize Afghanistan. And we have seen in the past attacks that targeted both Shiites and non-Shiite groups in the country, defenseless people throughout the country. And these terrorist attacks were mostly indiscriminate by nature. And this has only fueled sectarian violence in the country. And that is exactly what the terrorists try to achieve.
So do you think Daesh's aims are religious or are they political?
I think their convictions are mostly political, but unfortunately they are abusing religion convictions to justify their aim. Daesh is they're a hardcore Salafist group of terrorists supported and backed by the Gulf states, the Persian Gulf monarchies. They have poured billions upon billions of dollars to bring about such a infamous group of terrorists called Daesh. And their aspirations are very simple. They abuse Islam, and their version of Islam, so to speak, is the one that doesn't allow for any interpretation. They're not very different from what the Taliban is or used to be. They are very strict in their ideology, because let's call for what it is. They're rather an ideology than that they have anything to do with the religion of Islam, which is a very peaceful religion full of serenity. But Daesh, we have seen what they did in Syria. We have seen what they did in Iraq, killing innocent people, beheading people, even organ eating. Terrorists were seen in different footages. So suspicion is bound to arise. They have political aspirations. They want a full-spread domination of Central Asian region. And hadn't it been for countries like Iran, Russia, and China, you know, they could have pretty well achieved their aim, which, God willing, will never happen.
Sir, one last question. How do you see this unfolding in the future?
Well, I always tell to many friends that the suffering of the Afghan people has been immense, ongoing. Unless there is a genuine effort by the international community to stand with the Afghan people and to stop this insecurity in the country, right now Afghanistan is facing a huge crisis, food shortage, hunger, famine, you name it. Unless there is the world doesn't act to support the Afghan nation, I'm afraid things will only get from bad to worse. And you also mentioned the rivalry between great powers. I hope that that will come to a speedy and unconditional end, because Afghanistan and the Afghan nation are the ultimate victims.
Mr. Ariyali, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Afghan-Australian scholar and writer Farahonda Akbar says a new shade of narrative is emerging in post-Taliban takeover of Afghanistan about the unending saga of Hazara tragedies, an issue she believes has always been politicized. Salim Javed, a Gothenburg-based Afghan activist and writer, refers to the Uyghur identity of the suicide bomber in Kunduz, noting that his facial features resembling Hazaras made it difficult to prevent his entry to the mosque. Stanford University lecturer Mehdi Hakimi condemns the criminal silence of political leaders in Afghanistan over the massacre of Hazara Shias in Kunduz, saying it sends the wrong message to terrorists.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
India and China share an ill-defined 3,440-kilometer-long disputed border. Rivers, lakes, and snow caps along the frontier mean the line can shift, bringing soldiers face-to-face at many points, sparking a confrontation. There is a line of actual control where opposing troops maintain their positions and control with it, something like an informal border where both countries are racing to build infrastructure to legitimize control, such as India's construction of a new road to a high-altitude airbase, which sparked a conflict in June 2020. The border conflict is extremely important and crucial to resolve, as it has sparked a war between both countries in 1962. But both neighbors are armed with nuclear weapons, and we need to critically analyze really why the conflict exists in the first place.
According to the Economic Times, on 30th of August 2021, close to 100 soldiers of China's People's Liberation Army, PLA, crossed 5 kilometers across the line of actual control, or LAC, last month. The Chinese troops returned after a few hours from the area, guarded by the Indo-Tibetan Border Police, ITBP, so there was no standoff. Even earlier, anti-China sentiments in India were gaining momentum since the flare-up of the border dispute between the two countries last year at Galwan Valley, the first time in 45 years that soldiers died in a standoff between India and China. In April 2020, India moved to curb foreign investment from neighboring countries. These initiatives were taken in a bid to primarily stop Chinese companies from acquiring smaller and financially vulnerable Indian companies. The ultimate goal was to prevent, quote, predatory investments in these companies, particularly from China. A broad movement of anti-Chinese consumerism occurring inside India was also heightened with US former President Trump's visit to India, but very few actually know the reason for this conflict and havoc. Britain ruled over the South Asian region countries for about 200 years, before which the East India Company had already rid the region of its riches. The subcontinent region's global economic share dropped from 25% when they took control to merely 2% when they left. Having control over countries like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, as well as parts of Afghanistan and China, the British ruled with a divide-and-rule policy wherein they employed division tactics between the people based on religion, political ideas, language, ethnicity, and even skin color. The aim was simple: to keep these people in conflict with each other so that the colonizers could keep control and steal riches meanwhile.
The people of the subcontinent were getting tired and frustrated of the British rule. Despite failed wars of independence and promises of independence on support of allies during the two world wars, the British did not leave. But after stealing away most of the riches of India and having been faced with a new independence movement spearheaded by leaders like Gandhi, the British were finally forced to leave. The British left the region but made sure that their colonial footprint and influence remained. Power players like China, India, and Pakistan were forced to get stuck in a quagmire because of British policies.
After the British left the subcontinent, there were three conflicts to resolve. One was between Pakistan and India over Jammu and Kashmir, one was between Pakistan, India, and China over Ladakh, and one was between India and China in the Tibetan region of Arunachal Pradesh. During the time British had control over India, the provinces which we see currently in Pakistan, India and Bangladesh were in actual princely states ruled mostly by the favorites of the British Empire who paid taxes to the Empire and showed unquestionable loyalty. The British left it in the hands of the princes of the states to decide which countries they wanted to join. At that time, there were two, India and Pakistan. After the British left, it is inconclusive as to whether Maharaja Singh of Kashmir joined India or Pakistan. War broke out between India and Pakistan in 1948 for control of Kashmir, and both established line of control in disputed Kashmir areas, a conflict which exists till this day. When the issue came between Pakistan and China over Shaksgam Valley and areas in Ladakh, both countries settled it, and while this territory was ceded to China, China also ceded 1,942 square kilometers territory to Pakistan. This was not recognized by India, which still calls the land its own. Now regarding China and India, here is the story. While in control, the British Empire redrew the border lines as they saw fit, according to their own interests. Initially, in 1897, the British added the Aksai Chin region in the Kashmir province and transferred it to the Prince of Kashmir. However, in 1899, the British gave the same Aksai Chin region to China. India stuck with claims to 1897 lines, while China stuck with lines drawn for China in 1899, thus the confusion. With both countries stuck to the different boundary lines, both claimed Aksai Chin theirs. This was ultimately followed by the Indo-China War in 1962, where India lost some of its territories, while China fermented its control in Aksai Chin. The strife between India and Pakistan and India and China run till this day.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Binoy Kampmark, an author and columnist for The Mandarin. Now welcome to the program, Mr. Kampmark. First of all, could you explain what the situation is between China and India? What is the border dispute all about, and where does it stand currently?
Well, just as a general kind of thing, of course, many of your listeners and viewers would be aware that there's been a dispute, of course, between China and India that has been going on essentially since Indian independence, and also with China's turning over, as it were, to communism, of course, with Mao Zedong. But the significant thing that relates to the current border situation goes right back to 1962, where there was a border dispute which resulted actually in a war. And the war, of course, over Himalayan provinces, and that resulted in a very heavy Indian defeat. And in a sense, that has left a very bad taste in the mouth of Indian officials. It's also meant that both these powers have been in constant rivalry. And the reason why there are issues lately of significance is because both sides have been developing infrastructure, almost teasing and taunting each other on either sides, as it were, in the Galwan Valley, the Ladakh area, as it's called, and have resulted, as it were, in some fatal clashes that took place last year. So there have been these sporadic clashes, but also recent meetings that have not been successful in resolving this particular dispute.
Now, can you tell us a bit more about the background and the role that the British Empire played in all of this?
Well, I mean, the important thing about this, of course, is that the British, as they have done in other parts of the world, have left a very ambiguous legacy in terms of borders, because one of the things that we see in terms of Tibet and in terms of the outlying territorial aspects, if you like, between India and China, are these ambiguous, you know, demarcations, which is very significant. In fact, individuals such as the British officer Henry McMahon famously demarcated a border in 1914 in Tibet. This is not a border that's accepted very much by the Chinese, but it's one of significance. The same thing with other officials associated with the British East India Company. They were very famous, of course, in jotting and charting borders in terms of whether powers would observe them or not. But of course, in the aftermath of the British leaving India, and then of course with the event that, you know, with the arrival of Mao Zedong, this almost became redundant. But that legacy, if you like, the territorial legacy, still lingers in terms of disputes over borders.
So the British can say they already left. Why haven't China and India resolved their border disputes, and why haven't Pakistan and India resolved their own border disputes?
Well, I suppose in a sense all of them are linked, because Pakistan itself being an outgrowth of partition, an Indian, you know, the result of course, India failing to resolve its internal differences, and a lot of this being attributed also to British foreign policy. I don't necessarily think it should be attributed exclusively to the British, but nonetheless it's important to appreciate. And of course also the Chinese remembering foreign policy depredations in terms of how they were treated in terms of Western powers. So you've got India, you've got Pakistan, you've got China. And in a sense, all these individual countries are jousting or trying to find some kind of equilibrium in the region. And so the British legacy still remains, and you know, Britain itself doesn't necessarily have much of a direct hand, but they certainly have much of a hand in terms of their legacy in disputing territories and so forth. Certainly when it comes to, you know, matters and, you know, as simple as border posts, as simple as you know, the Aksai Chin Plateau and these areas, the British influence is still very much there.
Thank you, Mr. Kampmark. So glad to have you here on the program. Now, let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Brahma Chelene, a New Delhi-based strategic thinker and commentator, says the Himalayas have become the most dangerous flashpoint of the Indo-Pacific region amidst escalating tensions between regional rivals India and China. Former Bangladeshi army official and diplomat Shahidul Haq points to blame games between India and China, which he says has made efforts to negotiate a way out of the ongoing border row between them increasingly difficult.
And that was our episode on the devastating bombing in Afghanistan and colonial roots in present issues of the subcontinent. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Economic divide.
Did you know that there was a global economic meltdown that is taking place? This is no scare tactic, believe me. We all know that COVID-19 pandemic has dented the world economic growth, affecting businesses and people's livelihoods. Hi, I'm Kavit Halfway. In this edition of Economic Divide, we'll tell you how the entire world has been propped up by central banks around the world, accumulating massive deficits in the process. Now, coming up in today's program, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected the world economy. But did you know by how much and how badly? How does $834 million an hour sound? And that is to keep the economy alive. Then, the key question needs to be asked. Why did central banks have to do that? Why did they have to print money? To help companies stay afloat during lockdowns, which led to the biggest stock market rally of a generation. And finally, we're going to take a look at the central bank's function, how they absorb so much of the bond market, more than $16 trillion in debt with a negative yield to have been accumulated. Is this a debt time bomb that's overdue, waiting to happen?
Borrowing and debt, they go hand in hand, and there was plenty of that going on around the world last year. Governments, households, and companies raised $24 trillion last year to offset the pandemic's economic toll. By doing that, the global debt was pushed to an all-time high of almost $300 trillion. That is more than the 355% of global GDP, according to the Institute of International Finance. And there's even more borrowing ahead. The COVID pandemic has added $24 trillion to the global debt mountain over last year. That means that the debt as a ratio of world economic output, known as gross domestic product, has surged by 35 percentage points to over 355% of world GDP. This is well beyond the rise seen during the global financial crisis, and there's also little sign of near-term stabilization. borrowing levels are expected to run well above pre-COVID levels in many countries and sectors again this year, supported by still low interest rates, although the reopening of economies should help on the GDP side of the equation. The IIF has said we expect global government's debt to increase by another $10 trillion this year and to surpass $92 trillion, adding that winding down support could also prove even more challenging than it was after the financial crisis.
The problem with debt and money printing is that they are short-term solutions with long-term problems, which puts the future generations at risk. Let's not forget that the 2008 financial crisis, which started in the U.S. and spread across the world, had large stimulus spending. If you recall, they were called bailouts. The U.S. government spent around $700 billion, called the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008. The EU amount, though, came in at a much higher cost. How could anyone forget the then ECB central bank chief Mario Draghi, who said the ECB will do whatever it takes to save the euro? That whatever it takes amount to €2 trillion. Well, joining us for a cost breakdown literally is Jack Rasmus. He's a professor of economics at St. Mary's College and Santa Clara University. He also holds a PhD in political economy and is the author of The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump. Well, Jack, welcome. Global central banks led by the U.S. Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, and also the Bank of Japan, unbelievably, have collectively spent $834 million an hour, that's $13.9 million per minute, for the past 18 months to keep businesses rolling. I mean, it's hard to even wrap our mind around that figure. What does that mean? I mean, does it mean if it didn't do that, the world economy would fall apart?
Well, you know, you got to distinguish between central bank balance sheet debt, which you started talking about, and what the sovereign governments undertake in terms of debt on their spending programs and tax programs. And then you probably should talk about local government, provinces, states, and so forth, which aren't even in that data. And then there's household debt and there's corporate business debt.
All right, but that doesn't answer the question as to why there are reports that so much money has actually been spent by these central banks. I mean, on what sector is this money being spent on?
The level of debt by itself is not the whole problem. You can have an increasing level of debt as long as the economy, the real economy, is growing. GDP is growing. Of course, it hasn't been. What's important is the ability to service that excess debt. Service meaning pay the principal and interest down the road. When you can't pay the principal and interest, that's when you have defaults. Now, sovereign debt, you're not going to default. Certainly not in the United States. The U.S. can monetize that debt, print money, whatever, right? But corporate debt is another question. And household debt is another question, and even state and local government debt is another question. We shall see whether the consequence of this COVID-exacerbated global recession, which is still with us, not just COVID still with us, but the recession still with us, what you got is a rebound of the economy in the U.S. You don't have a sustained recovery yet. We shall see whether the real economy is going to generate enough income to service that massive debt addition that's occurred here. You know, just to take the Federal Reserve.
It's time now for our InfoNews section. As you're well aware by now, here's where we pick up stories that best reflect the theme of our program, social inequality, poverty, and injustice. Now, first up, an event that would have taken place by the time you're watching this program, and that is the UN Food Summit. Now, the summit said that it's not going to achieve anything meaningful because of corporations. And this is pretty important. And the reason why it said that is because it says that corporations have engineered our current broken food systems. So So that is what needs to be addressed by the summit, if that is something that will actually get done. That is the key question. On to Europe and gas prices there. You're well aware by now gas prices there are skyrocketing. Obviously, that's going to pose a big worry for the EU economy as a whole. European gas prices to have been hitting record highs. What is the reason behind that? Well, some say it's due to low storage volumes and the fast approaching winter, but low supplies from Russia and uncertainty about the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline are other reasons. And also the lack of drivers. It is said that they need 90,000 drivers to actually deliver the fuel. So that's another reason for this. And talk about oil. China's oil imports is our next topic. China has cut its oil imports and has ramped up purchases of natural gas, and it has reduced its crude imports by 5.7% since the start of 2021. At the same time, it has boosted natural gas purchases by over 20%. It seems that independent refineries slowed their restocking due to official probes into trading and taxes. Then moving on here to AI technology, big concern, the UN human rights chief coming out calling for a global halt to sales of dangerous AI technologies. Why is she calling AI technologies dangerous? Well, yes, AI has to serve people, that's undeniable, but AI's ability to feed human rights violations or to commit human rights violations, to be part of that, at an enormous scale with virtually no visibility, that is a problem. And her remarks came at the hearing of the Pegasus scandal, the Israeli spyware firm which was used to target civilians.
To Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section of the program. For this topic, we're going to take a look at what's called QE and what it means and how it functions in order to get a better idea of why this program has been popular. Now, quantitative easing, or QE as it is called, is referred to the introduction of new money into the money supply by a central bank. Now, this process, quantitative easing, helps the economy. How does it do that? It reduces long-term interest rates, making businesses and mortgage borrowing cheaper, and by signaling the Fed's intention to keep using monetary policy to support the economy. But the Fed turns to this process, QE, when short-term interest rates actually fall nearly to zero and the economy still needs help. In response to the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Federal Reserve has actually done some things regarding the QE. It has cut the short-term interest rate down to zero. That happened on March 15, 2020, and restarted its large-scale asset purchases, more commonly known as quantitative easing, or QE. And since July of 2020, the Fed has been buying $80 billion of Treasury securities and $40 billion of agency mortgage-backed securities each month. Now, the potentially imminent decision by the Fed to begin reducing this $120 billion in monthly asset purchases, the Fed Chair Powell said that the weeks since the Fed's policy meeting in July brought more progress towards repairing the jobs market, with nearly a million positions added, and that progress should continue.
Today, the Federal Open Market Committee kept interest rates near zero and maintained our current pace of asset purchases. These measures, along with our strong guidance on interest rates and on our balance sheet, will ensure that monetary policy will continue to support the economy until the recovery is complete.
Obviously, the key there, until the recovery is complete. However, this also coincided with the further spread, unfortunate for the U.S. and the world, of the Delta variant.
What happened was Delta happened, and you have this very sharp spike in Delta cases, and I think, so that affects, for example, when schools are open 60% of the time, or when they're always at a threat of being closed because of Delta, the Delta variant, you know, you might want to wait. Rather than going ahead and taking a job and starting work only to have to quit it 3 weeks later, you're going to wait until you're confident of that.
Yeah, obviously there the Fed is explaining the QE program, why it needs to continue, because he says one reason is that people are going to go out there and get a job, but yet they're going to have to quit because of COVID. They're not going to do that. Well, the further spread